Tonight's talk is on the seven factors of enlightenment. The particular factor is calm. I'll try to maintain my poise during the... I might start with the fact that calm is not determined by the metabolic rate of an activity. There can be people who are very active and still abide in calm. And then there are people who we can see by their movements and actions are very steady and slow in their movements, and can also be rather frenetic in how they hold the world. So you can't associate calm necessarily with metabolism. And that's important because we often look for the outward signs for the inward message, and they aren't always in parallel with one another. Thank God. I would like to start with a story about the retreat, actually. There were a couple of people on the retreat who were having issues of evil and good in themselves. And often I would speak to them in private, and often making public statements with the whole group together about, bring the devil on. Let's just have the devil on. Let's just bring him on. Enough of this hiding. Bring them out. I'm not going to be afraid of anything. Bring it out. Meaning any sense of separation or division is not tolerable at some point in the mind. And all we're afraid of when we're afraid of obscure images like the devil or death are our own minds recoiling back in fear of itself. So bring it on. Bring it on. So then I went home. And I was going through my mail. And the first letter I opened was it had my name on it. And it was from the Queen Anne Baptist Church, which I knew nothing about. Opened it up and there was a brochure. And it said, "The Truth About Hell." And underneath it, it says, "You could be in serious danger." So once my mind worked with the serendipity of all that, and I felt a little strange about the quick communication, I thought, bring him on. Bring him on. But we better do it with calm, or we just add more of the inferno to the struggle. And so tonight, I want to talk about how to hold the world of division and the world of separation. You see, the next... next three talks in this series are very important talks to bring this whole thing together. If we look at, we can look at the seven factors. The first factor, of course, is that direct observation of mindfulness. And nothing happens. None of the factors are cultivated without that particular factor being the steadying factor, the grouping factor of all the other factors. But then as we look at the next three factors, energy, investigation, and energetic or joyful interest, those are arousing, energetically arousing factors of mind. Now we come to the balancing factors. The balancing factors are calm, samadhi, and equanimity. So those factors, those arousing energetic factors, it can get out of hand if they aren't balanced. They can get caught up in a whole sense of curiosity that goes much beyond curiosity into rumination and mulling over and extrapolating and proliferating out into an energetic field way beyond the immediate moment. So what keeps these factors imbalanced and somewhat contained are the factors that we are going to be talking about for the rest of this series. And the first of those factors is the factor of calm. Calm. You know, you can almost get a sense of a motionless sea, a calm sea. The word actually brings out a sense for me of nature, of a harmonious movement through nature, unruffled, unwavered, grounded in the earth. The sense of calm is a grounded quality, steady quality. It's the quality that we try to nourish when we talk about the precepts, when we say, refrain from taking life, refrain from taking that which isn't given. That refrain, that pause and refrain, allows the energetic reaction that we're about to move, which is the reactivity of division and separation, the activity of rebuking or punishing or causing harm, to be considered. And you can see that it really pulls out that domino, so that when the reactivity, the series of conditioned reactivity falls with the domino out, the next movement, which is the actual action itself, can be refrained from. There can be that sane pause in life. Would somebody mind shutting the blinds? Right. Thank you. It's a very settled energy where the feeling is the burden has been removed from life. The burden has been removed. And the beauty of calm is that it stops. It stops us in mid-flight. Now, I mean, just as you go through this week, just ask, you know, when you feel yourself at a rather frenetic pace, or anxious or worried in some way, just to give that pause and refrain. Does life have to be about this? Is this what life has to be? And if we stand for nothing in this congregation, in this organization, it's that it doesn't. Well, how are we going to know that if we just go pell-mell with the series of events, sort of, you know, folding, one event folding into the next? When are we going to allow ourselves to pause and refrain, to ask, let calm arise in this moment? Where is there calm in this moment? And we begin to see that we will lose our calm even within our meditation, when our meditation is geared towards a result. Because anytime you have a goal or a result for anything, you have then the tendency to worry about how close you are to that reward. And in that comparison, calm is no longer able to arise. So much of what we're talking about in meditation is the releasing of having to have the meditation a certain way for our practice to be fully engaged. It's amazing how quickly the mind senses that something is wrong with itself and creates the opposite environment in its imagination that says that my life won't ever be settled and complete or happy until this particular emotion or physical sensation or whatever it might be is removed from it. We don't realize that just in the pursuit of an imaginative world separate from the real one, which is full of the anger or the angst or the annoyance that we're trying desperately to rid ourselves of, in that movement, is in the abstract, in the conceptual, is the loss of calm. We lose the ability to be calm. It seems as if just the opposite. We'll find calm when this is removed. But calm, the sense of refraining, the sense of pausing, the sense of stopping, says, this is sufficient here. Let me look no further. Look no further. It's a beautiful phrase to interject into your meditation at some point when you feel as if you are looking for something further. Look no further. Or add nothing to this moment. I think that 90% of my encouragement for all of us here is to begin to have faith that the seeing, the observation is enough. That we need nothing else to make our lives complete, but the total dropping, the total stopping. And it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. The ability to stop within any circumstance makes it complete. Let me say that again. The conditions are not what makes a situation complete. It's our willingness to stop within the conditions, not trying to force them into something else other than what they are, that makes our lives content. It's in the Bible, there's a beautiful refrain that says something like, be still and know you are God. Be still and know you are God. It's interesting, Ellen and I were walking through Seward Park some time ago, and we were walking through the beautiful forest that they have in the center of the park, and we were coming out to one of the big fields, and there was some sort of a revival mission or something going on, and they had these huge speakers that were, 10, 20 feet high, and the woman was blaring out that was shocking. I mean, it was really shocking the whole system. She was singing, be still and know you are God. Oh, God. Why didn't you take that in, lady? But it is, I don't think that very many people understand what that means, because therein is the heart of Buddhism as well as perhaps Christianity itself. Be still. Be still. Without conditions, be still. Be still in the midst of disappointment and the lack of understanding and the annoyance of the situation and the irritation and the anger of the moment. Be still. Be still. For that is where completion rests. And calm is the first indication, it's the first pointing towards that stillness. It's the first movement that says stillness is enough. There's a beautiful story of a man who goes to the Zen master who's terminally ill and very close to death, and he says, Zen master, how should I die spiritually? And the Zen master says, die quietly. Die quietly. We want the horns to blow, don't we? We want the drums to beat. We want the troops to be rallied to our bedside. Die quietly. Live quietly. Live quietly with calm. I had a teen class last year, and there was a 14 or 15-year-old girl in it. And we had taught the meditation in a different way to be, emphasizing relaxation. And she went home, and her family was one that was anything but relaxed. It was a very anxious family, and she could feel the incidences that led to the whole family ratcheting up their anxiety. And so she was sitting on the couch and something happened. And then the anxiety level in the room started to rise. And her normal place in that was to follow suit. But since the meditation class, she said, you know, I don't need to do this. I don't need to follow suit. I can be relaxed here. And so she didn't. And she saw the effect it had on the other family members when she didn't engage in the anxious behavior. And she came back and told that story. The 15-year-old in the family, the 15-year-old was the one that was able to pull out the domino from falling. We have to have a very humble attitude towards our busyness and towards our anxious worrying, because we put so much of our own sense of self-worth on top of our busyness, don't we? And so much of our validation in terms of our worry. It's so interesting to see how much of life we are connected to through worry, as if life wouldn't go along in accordance to its design without our worry, that it needs our concern in order for it to steer in the direction to course correct itself. And that also worry in some ways is a manifestation that we really care. When somebody is ill and we're not worried about them, the question would come up, do we really care about them when we're not worried? As if caring was connected to any state but calm. But in fact, calm is the state of caring. That caring can really only come from calm. And if we've ever been in the presence of somebody who is calm, who is steady, we can also feel that person's caring. And how much different it feels when somebody comes to the bedside worried, frantically over-involving themselves. And we think, you know, that tension somehow holds our relationship with the person. It's very difficult to slow down. In fact, the efforts to slow down are really misplaced, I think. Now, I would never tell the beginning class that. Because the beginning class, if there is one common theme that everybody wants out of the meditation, is some calm and peace of mind. But I'm going to say this to you, that to try to force the reins on the horse, to try to pull them up, is to not understand why they're in full gallop. We want to know why they're in full gallop, because pulling in the reins is going to last as long as you have the reins pulled in. As soon as you let go, you're back to full gallop. You're not going to realize what the advantages of calm are until you learn the disadvantages of a busy life. So if you find yourself speeding recklessly through the day, which I dare say is probably the condition of most of our lives, where the moment means nothing. It's getting through the moment, enduring the moment, and then the future represents everything for us. Every sense of relaxation, every sense of ease is not found within the busyness of our job, of our family, not even in the motionlessness of sleep, because all we do, we worry ourselves to sleep. We wake up with a jolt of anxiety often, bouncing out of bed, racing through that, as if there was going to be some moment in our 70 years of history that will all of a sudden come to full rest. and that we have been working towards that end. And that sometime it's going to feel complete, and then that will be it. Well, if you've ever been at the bedside of someone who has died, you know it never comes. It never comes. Even in retirement or a change of lifestyle, when we think, finally, no, it doesn't. It doesn't come because we were never really looking for that. In fact, we were never really interested in that. We were interested in it enough so that when we said, it was like, I'm hurting because of all this speed. There's a sense that we're hurting because of all this speed. But there's never a complete ownership of why it is that we speed around. We just long for its alternative, never realizing that when we're faced with that alternative, we don't want it because it doesn't validate us. Busyness validates us. We feel needed when we're busy. We feel productive. Productive. The little me works on its own productivity. That's why it's so difficult to sit routinely in our lives when we're at home. Nothing in particular is going on. We have the time. Let's not fool ourselves to say that our day is so filled that we couldn't find 45 minutes. Let's be honest. But somehow that 45 minutes gets covered over, doesn't it? Somehow, we move into activity. We know that it's there, but then we forget and move on and never get around to the sitting because it's the busyness that confirms. It's the productivity that shows us that we have some meaning in a meaningless life. So we're just playing the hand out here. We're just showing, you know, bring it on. Right? Bring it on. In order to keep ourselves meaningful in what we fear is a meaningless life, which is the root of despair for us, stopping, then life has no meaning, and we have no meaning within it, and that's one of our greatest fears. So, anything but that. Let's just keep it going. Let's just keep that engine running. And soon it gets out of hand. Soon it becomes the metabolism. Soon it becomes the idle speed of us all. We don't even know where we lost it. And hooked to that idle speed is a kind of ambition, a reflex ambition that says somehow ties our sense of self-worth to the accomplishments of the day. Now, we have to break that, but we can't break that just by giving ourselves a good scolding and a good talk and then laying out 45 minutes where we'll clear out the schedule. We have to look at whether this is a truly meaningful life when we stay as busy as we've been. We have to examine it. We have to investigate it. The third factor of enlightenment. In order to find our way to calm. In order to find our way into how this life can possibly be meaningful on its own terms, at its own speed. We feel it when we're in nature. We're feeling it when we walk and feel the sun on our shoulder, or sun on our shoulders, or the wind touching us. We feel it. There's something there that's authentically real. What happens to that sense of authenticity? You see? What happens to, because we're being held in that moment, the environment of life is holding us. And for a moment we may have stopped and really feel the value of that holding, of that ability to listen, which is why I read that poem. Where the water is at the top of the glass and it's overflowing. I can't tell you how many people in that moment have a sense of being undeserving of that. Or that this is just self-indulgence. Isn't that amazing? We whip ourselves into shape. And anything that would give us a brief respite from that beating, that self-flagellation, is self-indulgence. It shows a complete lack of any self-metta or self-love. Any understanding of what life is on its own terms, validated not through our productivity and usefulness, but through its own beauty and ours as well. Zen teacher John Turan said this, "The development of character and integrity becomes our work, and listening to the silence becomes our practice. In these ways, we align ourselves with the mystery that is always present and discover what is being asked of us at the deepest level. The development of character and integrity becomes our work, and listening to the silence becomes our practice." That willingness to have a soft character, to allow softness of character. I had a problem with my back some time ago, and I went to a physical therapist. And he was giving me some exercises on a previous appointment, and then he had me do the exercises in front of him that he had given me in that previous appointment. And so I was doing the exercises, and as I do most things, like yoga and those kinds of things, I was overstraining. And he puts his hands gently on my back, and he says, "You know, the body works much more in softness and gentleness." And I thought to myself, I hope he hasn't looked at my vocation. Maybe I can get out of here without him asking. It just comes, doesn't it? It's in ourselves, our sense of worth. Driven by a sense of unworthiness, we seek a sense of worth. And the way we seek a sense of worth is by our doing, by manifesting, by showing people what we've done. We fixed this many things, or made that many things, or wrote this many things. And then we can validate our life through those accomplishments. We can look back through the catalog and say, "Yes, I had a good life. Look what I did. Look what I did. Look what I did." Not look what I was. Not look at my being. Look at the voice of my being. It's exactly the same as the woman blaring out, "Be still and know you are God." Exactly the same. The soft character. The character that's willing to die quietly. That smells out reactivity, is on to something here when we feel ourselves reactive. Because reactivity is a given through productivity. It's a given. if we think in terms of our lives being productive, then reactivity is going to accompany that logic. Has to. But when we think in terms of being, not just character, but resting in being. Esse quam videri is the motto of North Carolina. To be rather than to seem. To live in that, then that which takes us out of its essence needs to be investigated. That's all. What is going on here? Why would I lose my footing in my calm? Why would I move out of the organic naturalness, the authentic naturalness of my being? Why would I ever want to do that? And so reactivity is an indication that we have lost our way, that we have tripped. Okay, so let's look at that. It isn't a given. It's something that we need to look at. So to look at our busyness, to investigate our busyness, is the way to find calm. Why is it that we need to be this busy? And to be ruthlessly honest at what we see. The Dalai Lama said, I worry a lot. Any response to vexation other than being calm is unwise. I worry a lot. Any response to vexation other than calm is unwise. When we allow ourselves to listen and to be receptive, to invite calm in, we are offering up, we're offering our timing to the timing of the universe. That's essentially the big obstacle. It's not our timing. It's the timing of the universe. It's the universe's timing. So therein, calm is very connected to patience. Patience. Like when we're angry. Anger, in its heart, is an impatient response to a particular situation. And it's the power display of the reactivity. It's the food for the sense of me. But what if we just allowed ourselves to soften? First, not demanding that we don't be angry, which is more anger, but just allowing the timing of the anger to have its say, the movement of the energy to have its place within the body embodiment of calm so that we feel it. It's okay, it's feeling, but we keep it within, we keep it embodied within calm, softening to it, allowing it to show its disturbance, why life is not working in accordance to our timing, to our direction, to our values. And we do this with a sense of settledness because we're interested in the reactivity of the anger. We're interested in learning what the anger feeds upon, why it gets its nourishment, where it pulls in its substance, how it maintains itself. And it's right there. We see it. We feel the feelings of power. We feel the feelings of righteousness. We feel the wave of reactive energy that will lead to more doing and more damage in the doing. And we're taking, okay, look at this, okay. Now we have to have extraordinary reserve. We have to be so interested in our life that is the priority for our living, is to find out why living is taken from us, why we give our living away, better said, why we release our living, why we give it away, why we give our life away. Our life has to be so important to us that we will not allow ourselves to give it away anymore. And we give it away in reactivity. I want to know why I give it away. No one's doing this to us. It's not the devil. Why am I giving away my life? See, that question should build passion and interest, which is the third factor of enlightenment. You see how these factors nourish themselves in life, through life, through life's inquiry. So now I'm very interested. Much more interested than I am playing out my power. Much more interested than in the reactive response of separation and division. Because I have investigated that and I saw that it hurts me and it hurts others. And I'm not so interested in hurting anymore. Fair enough. I'm interested in adding life to itself, not diminishing life by cutting off or separating out. So I want to replenish life. It's a movement towards generosity of spirit. But in order to do that, I have to have a seat in calm. Calm is essential for the learning of how I give life away. Because if I just do it from anger, then anger can't see anger. Anger just only sees its righteousness. I can't look from anger. I look from that which holds anger, that which allows anger to arise within it, which is awareness. And what's an attribute of awareness? Calm. So this takes extraordinary faith. Why do I use that word? Because we're not in the picture anymore. We're not getting anything out of this. Nobody is going to come up to us and pat us on the back. Nobody is going to certify us or proclaim us or acknowledge us. Not to any extent. Not to the sense of self's extent. You can do a much better job being angry. Look at our political figures. So anger is where you get self-validated. Not in calm. Calm is the loss of self-validation, the loss of me being validated. But calm's available to hear that music, and anger is not. And that music never disturbs, no matter how loud it's played. In the Bible, just to bring another verse up, it says, Lord, teach me to wait. He who waits upon the Lord teach me to wait. Not wait in the sense of tapping our foot in time to our watch, but truly stopping in calm. And then we'll be renewed in strength. For what we are doing in practice is falling into the universe's timing. Away from the validation of reactivity. Towards the heart of being. And any qualities of character, like calm, that can bring us a step closer, a step more interested in the reactive response that depletes us, is a tool we thrive upon, we nurture and cultivate, and arouse within us. Where is calm in this moment? Where is calm in this moment? Where is sanity in this moment? There was a woman who called me on the phone once, and it was late at night, and she had something, she had to say, she was having a spiritual emergency or something. And she was just ranting and raving. But it was a long distance call, it was from North Carolina. And I said to her, you know, I really can't listen to you. Will you put the woman on the phone who had the sanity to find my number and dial it? Because that's the person I'd like to speak to. This other one was just, she thought, you know, now she had me on the phone, she had to validate why she had to wake me up at night. And she did it through her ranting and raving to show us how insane she was. I wasn't interested in that at all. Well, I'm no good at that. Don't come to me like that. I'm not, you seek out psychiatrists and psychologists and counselors. I don't know what to do with that. I'm interested in your sanity. What lies under that? You know, that little thing that knows? That piece of us that has a continuity of knowing? That even when we were the most inebriated, the most reactive, there's this little part of us, that's the part. Let that grow. And let us speak from that. Because therein lies calm. Therein lies nurturance. Therein lies sanity. And so when we turn to the difficult in our meditation, when we turn to reactivity, let us use calm, the quality of calm, in that turning. Let us turn with calm. Not with fear, not with the devil in mind, but with calm. Let me look at this pain. Let me see what's there. And I don't focus on the results, which is the ending of it, the alleviation of it. If we do that, then we have lost the state of calm. We settle in the abiding within it and look clearly at it, with it. May all beings be in a state of calm. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if anyone has any comments or questions, I would be happy to do my best. Yes. Right. When you're spinning out of control in reactivity and busyness, how do you get to the state of investigation when it's the farthest thing from your mind? Sometimes you just move with the energy of it. I was telling a story when I was on retreat, and I woke up in the middle of the night and I couldn't catch my breath. I was having sleep apnea. And I was in a very small room and the windows were high up and it was like really hot and stuffy at night. It was in Ohio during a heat wave just a couple of weeks ago. And there was a deep panic in me. And I didn't try to arrest the panic. I went outside. I just did what the energetically my body felt like doing within that panic. Now, I have to inject here that doesn't mean playing out anger if it creates, not to harm someone or something from it. But to take yourself out and to beat on a tree or to yell or scream, those can be perfectly legitimate ways to let the energy move, as long as it's in a harmless direction. But I just let it, because I just have faith that the energy, first of all, is temporarily there, that it's not going to last forever, and that it has its own movement, and that this is just the law of the way this body moves, given. And but there was a part of me. And at some point it was larger, and sometimes it was smaller. It's like an eye, it's an aperture of a camera that would open and close depending upon how much panic was in. But it was always at least a focal length of 1/16, right? So it was always, even though it might have been very small, it was still there. And so I just followed it. I just let it play out. I didn't try to rest or sit up in some kind of and then it subsided, and then I kept waking up throughout the night, and And there's something that happened in relationship to fear, having gone through that over and over again. What is it? I don't know, but it just feels different to me. It's this, really. It's like, let it come. You know, I'm not afraid of you. Come on. And because much of our disaster is the fear of the reactivity, is the fear that we will be out of control, that we will lose our ability to govern harm and non-harm. That's not a given for me. I won't harm from energetically, outside of yelling. So I wouldn't be too strict on yourself in those times. Just try to keep the aperture as open as you can. That's going to have an effect. And over time, it begins to show you its effect by that particular reactive pattern playing less and less a unconscious role in your life. It comes on its own. Don't begrudge its own timing. Let it play itself out, and in its timing, it starts withering away under the gaze of that observation. It takes patience to do this. Extraordinary patience.
Could you expand on your point that our greatest fear is a meaningless life?
To expand on the point that our greatest fear is the meaninglessness of life. Well, and I mean, I don't want to send everybody off in despair. But really, life lived through the value system that we play on it, we place on it, is meaningless. Really, it's meaningless because we're going to die, and it's going to die. And the fact that it's going to change away from our productivity, no matter how glamorous and ennobling it was, is only temporarily here, ultimately shows the meaninglessness of the ambition in that direction. It doesn't mean that it temporarily doesn't have a place and point to invent something or to build something. But the ultimate meaning, you know, is not, I mean, you can't sort of rest your life on that, because it's all moving. And because it's really doesn't have anything to do with you. It's not a statement of being. It's a statement of production. It's external. Even poetry, you know, it's not. And what we begin to realize is that true meaningfulness, if we're to make this, the question of meaning never arises when we're alive. When we're alive, when we are abide in the moment, you don't look around and say, what's the meaningful thing to do? Or is my life meaningful? The question never arises. Isn't that interesting? Now, why doesn't it arise? Because living itself is the meaning. And then letting the life do what it needs to through its living, it will build bridges and do whatever it needs to. But it isn't the claim that we have on our meaning, isn't what we do. It's the living of it that is the meaning. It's like walking meditation. It really comes down to walking meditation. How does it come down to walking meditation? I thought you would ask that question. people don't get walking meditation. They say, well, I don't, you know, I get the sitting, but I don't get the walking. Why don't we get the walking? For the most part, when we're in movement, unless we're doing something useful in that movement, it's a waste of time. It's boring. It's not meaningful. It's walking back and forth. What good is it? You see? That's it, right there. There it is. Because we don't give any full expression to carrying life in movement. Movement represents what we're going to do from the movement, not movement on its own terms. You know, walking would come like that if we would enter our life. We wouldn't ask what was the point of walking. Walking's the point of walking. And discovering that, the best opportunity to discover that is to have a form in which you're doing nothing, in which you have to come up against all the resistances to doing nothing, which is the need to be productive, which is the reason why we never do nothing for its own sake. It's boring. It's not. What would my mother say about this? How am I going to tell anybody what I did this weekend? On and on it goes. And so we have to, all those feelings come up in walking. And what does it ultimately do? It says, I don't get walking. Because we have sided with the mind's need for walking to be meaningful in its terms, in terms of productivity. Are people, do you get that? See, what's the point of it? Was it all the kids I had and the job I did? What's the point of this? When we live in the, when we live abiding, there is nothing that obscures them. Everything enlivens the moment. The choir practice enlivens the moment. Because it's all a given. It's all part of the aliveness. It's all part of the manifestation, which is, and we are also part of that manifestation, that immediate manifestation. The manifestation in that arising moment is perfect. But when we come into that manifestation, outside of that manifestation, living life externally, looking through our thinking, oh, gosh, I feel lonely in this congregation, or how come no one's speaking to me? From that point of view, then the choir practice is a resistance, is an annoyance. It's an all or nothing affair. You can't hold out your little toe and expect it to be this way. You can't jump in to the water, but you just want to keep your hair from getting messed up. It's all or nothing. And that's why I don't teach a lot of time. Because that's the problem. We have been using time to come to a set of circumstances in which we can dive in. Has that worked? Our failure rate is abysmal. When are we just going to go? Other comments or questions? Okay.